Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota on Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.
What good are monks to the world? This is Chuck Coughlin, the historical apologist on Setting the Record Straight, brought to you on breadboxmedia.com. I have a very enjoyable good friend who's a Baptist preacher and quite a well-educated theologian. And we have some interesting discussions at breakfast about once a week. And we were talking about the monastery not far from my home, Our Lady of Gethsemane, near Bardstown. And he said, what good are they? They're wasting their lives. They don't do the world any good. And I said, don't you believe in the power of prayer? He said, well, maybe that, but that's about it. Producing cheeses and some fudge and stuff. Fruitcakes, who cares about those anyway? I said, well, they've done a bit more than that in history, you know. A lot of what we think of as our civilization was created by monks and developed further by monks. It's one more example of the unacknowledged inheritance of an entire culture that we live in. It was mainly inherited from the Catholic Church. Monks gave us great gifts, and they were generous with them. But I mean gifts in every intellectual field, engineering, everything. That's what we're going to talk about.
The contributions of the monks are so many, so varied, and so important that it's impossible to address it in one program, so there'll be a number on that subject. I want to start with their effect on their physical environment. The monks are champions of agriculture, of tilling the soil and making land useful. Why don't we start with the British Isles? Because this is a particularly vivid example of the monks' salutary influence on their physical surroundings. This example comes from the Fen district of Southampton, England. One has to love the sound of the word fen. Fen, F-E-N, which describes sort of a swampy pond whose cloudy waters may emit sulfurous smells from the decomposition of animal and plant materials. A swamp. An expert on landscape describes what the area looked like in the 7th century before the founding of Thorney Abbey. I quote, "It was nothing but a vast morass. The fens in the 7th century were probably like the forests at the mouth of the Mississippi or the swamp shores of the Carolinas. It was a labyrinth of black wandering streams, broad lagoons, morasses submerged by every spring tide, vast beds of reed and sedge and fern, vast copses of willow, alder, and gray poplar, rooted in the floating peat, which was swallowing up slowly, all devouring, yet all preserving. The forests of fir and oak and ash, poplar, hazel, and yew, which had once grown in that low rank soil. Trees torn down by flood and storm floated and lodged in rafts, damming the waters back upon the land, changed their channels, mingled silt and sand with the black soil of the peat. Nature, left to herself, ran into wild riot and chaos more and more, till the whole fen became one dismal swamp." 5 centuries later, after the attentions of the monks at Thorney Abbey, William of Malmesbury described the area in the early 1100s. "It is a counterfeit of paradise, where the gentleness and purity of heaven appear already to be reflected. In the midst of the fens rise groves of trees which seem to touch the stars with their tall and slender tops. The charmed eye wanders over a sea of verdant herbage. The foot which treads the wide meadows meets with no obstacle in its path. Not an inch of land as far as the eye can reach lies uncultivated. Here the soil is hidden by fruit trees, there by vines stretched upon the ground or trailed on trellises. Nature and art rival each other, the one supplying all that the other forgets to produce. O deep and pleasant solitude, thou hast been given by God to the monks, so that their mortal life may daily bring them nearer to heaven. Many historians have pointed out that the beautiful landscapes described in so many novels and shown in so many movies, clear streams, surmounted by charming arching stone bridges, the mill races, the small, comfortable human scale of things, the country lanes all bordered by hedgerows, ancient hedgerows. All this was produced by the hard labor of monks for 1,100 years.
It took 1,100 years, 11 centuries of prayer and work. Ora e labora, the monk's motto, ora e labora.
From the 600s up until the 15th century, when Henry VIII, out of desire to create his own religion with him as the Pope, set out to destroy the monasteries and did.
He disbanded the monastic communities, put them out on the street, and distributed the wonderful farmland of the monasteries, cultivated over 1,100 years of hard labor, distributed to the bought-off nobles for the price of supporting him in his new endeavor, his new Protestant Reformation. An additional condition was placed on the nobles that they demolish the main buildings of the monasteries within 6 months. This proved to be very expensive and difficult to do since they were so well constructed. This impoverished the peasants, whose small villages and communities had been built up around the monastery economy, where they had been tenants with lifelong leases at easy terms. This impoverished the vast peasant class of the British Islands. The economy was overturned. Now the leases were short-term and high rent, and unforgiving if the rent was missing. The monasteries, which had been hospitals and schools, now became the fine manors of the bought-off nobles. Ever wonder why the manors of the fine noble class of the British have names like Northanger Abbey or the fictitious Downtown Abbey or Tintern Abbey? These abbeys were stolen from the monks that were driven out into the streets. The lovely gardens and fountains were the unacknowledged inheritance from 11 centuries of labor. For the peasants now, there was no free medical care in the monastery. Now there were no monastery schools for the bright youngsters. There was another condition with the nobles, that they tear down the main buildings of these magnificent monasteries, smash the statuary and iconoclastically smash all of the stained glass windows. The stained glass windows showing scenes from the Bible, the pages of the Bible for the illiterate.
Of course it meant impoverishing the peasants who had centered their economic life around the monastery communities, around the beautiful and charming agricultural land we know as the English countryside, which was the product of monks, a gift to the monks.
A bit about the history of the monks. They played a critical role in the development of Western civilization. Judging from Catholic monasticism's earliest practice, one would hardly have guessed the enormous impact on the outside world that it would come to exercise. This is less than a surprise when we recall Christ's words, "Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all these things shall be added unto you." That, stated simply, is the history of the monks, which started first with their eyes on God, and then with their eyes still fixed upon the face of God, they turned their hands to making the earth a better place. The early forms of monastic life are evident by the 3rd century. Individual Catholic women committed themselves as consecrated virgins to lives of prayer and sacrifice, looking after the poor and sick. Nuns came from these early traditions. Another source of Catholic monasticism is found in St. Paul of Thebes and the more famous St. Anthony of Egypt, whose life spanned the mid-3rd century through the mid-4th century. Now, St. Anthony's sister lived in a house of consecrated virgins. He himself became a hermit, retreating to the deserts of Egypt for the sake of his own spiritual perfection, though his great example led thousands to flock to him. In the cities of the Roman Empire, periodic persecutions of Catholics
came in waves and then retreated. One might suspect that this periodic persecution most certainly must have motivated the early Catholics to retreat to outlying areas. The hermit's characteristic feature was his retreat into remote solitude, that he might renounce earthly things and concentrate intensely on the spiritual realm. Hermits typically lived alone or in groups of two or three, living in caves or simple huts, supporting themselves on what they could produce in small fields or through basket making and other tasks. The lack of an authority to oversee their spiritual regimen led some of them to pursue unusual spiritual and penitential practices. There were hermits who hardly ever ate or slept, others who stood without movement whole weeks together, or who had themselves sealed up in tombs, receiving only the least of poor nourishment through crevices in the masonry. Now, monks living together in monasteries, the kind with which most people are familiar, developed in part as a reaction against the life of the hermits, and in recognition of the fact that persons ought to live in the community. This was the position of St. Basil the Great, who played an important role in the development of Eastern monasticism. The hermit life never entirely died out. 1,000 years after St. Paul of Thebes, a hermit is elected pope. We know him as Celestine V. The monasticism of the East did influence the monasticism of the West. The travels of St. Athanasius, for example, and the writings of St. John Cassian, a man of the West who possessed a wide knowledge of Eastern practice. But Western monasticism is most deeply indebted to one of its own, St. Benedict of Nursia. He established 12 small communities of monks 38 miles from Rome, before heading 50 miles south to found Monte Cassino, the great monastery for which he is remembered. It was here, around 529, that he compiled the famous Rule of St. Benedict, the excellence of which was reflected in its all but universal adoption throughout Western Europe in the centuries that followed. Sadly, Monte Cassino was destroyed in the Second World War. Our own bombs did it, since the Nazi troops had taken refuge in Monte Cassino and were firing on our troops from above with impunity. They considered this a devilish trick to play upon Christians, who they believed would not fire back, especially the Catholics. After many deaths and injuries, General Eisenhower reluctantly gave their permission to fire back, and this magnificently beautiful monastery, which had been established in 529, was destroyed. The moderation of St. Benedict's rule, as well as the structure and sense of order that resulted from it, inspired its spread throughout Europe. Unlike the Irish monasteries, which were known for their extremes of self-denial. Though it must be mentioned that the Irish monasteries attracted men in considerable numbers. They joined by the thousands. The Benedictines in the 300s created Lecto Divina, an orderly way of studying the scriptures, repeating the reading, penetrating more deeply with instinct and rationality into their meaning. We still do it. It is another gift to the monks.
Do you know what happened later to Monte Cassino, the destroyed monastery?
The Benedictines rebuilt it according to the original plans. From its lofty site, it looks down on a cemetery of the graves of a huge number of Polish soldiers and Italian refugees who died in the retaking of the mountain. Throughout history's periods of great turmoil, the Benedictine tradition has endured since the 300s, and its houses have remained oases of order and peace. It has been often said of Monte Cassino, the mother house of the Benedictines, that her own history reflected that permanence. Sacked by the barbarian Lombards in 589, destroyed by the Saracens in 884, raised by an earthquake in 1349, pillaged by French troops in 1799, and wrecked by the bombs of World War II, our Allied bombs, in 1944. Monte Cassino has refused to disappear. Each time, her monks have returned to rebuild. The Benedictine monasteries took for granted that the monks were to receive adequate food and sleep, even if during penitential seasons his regimen might grow more austere. The Benedictine monk typically lived at a material level comparable to that of a contemporary Italian peasant. A monk's intention in retiring to a monastery was to cultivate a more disciplined spiritual life, and very specifically to work out his own salvation in an environment and under a regimen suitable to that purpose. the role of the monks in Western civilization would prove substantial. The monks' original intention had not been to perform great tasks for European civilization. Yet as time went on, they came to appreciate the task for which the time seemed to have called them. It's hard to do justice to the Benedictine achievement, but by the beginning of the 14th century, the order had supplied the church with 24 popes, 200 cardinals, 7,000 archbishops, 15,000 bishops. And how many canonized saints? 1,500. These figures are astounding and do reveal the magnitude and importance of the monasteries and as a foundation of European civilization as we know it. At its height, the Benedictine order could boast 37,000 monasteries. 37,000. And they had great influence outside the church also. The monastic ideal had become so exalted that by the 14th century, the order had already enrolled 20 emperors, 10 empresses, 47 kings, and 50 queens. A great many of Europe's most powerful would come to pursue the humble life and spiritual regimen of the Benedictine order. Even the various barbarian groups were attracted to the monastic life. We can use the word earthly for some of the most practical benefits of the monks who turned their hands to the earth. Their achievement in agriculture is a particularly significant example. It would be difficult to overemphasize this. The president of the Massachusetts Agricultural College, Henry Cadell, celebrated the work of these grand old monks during a period of 1,500 years. They saved agriculture when nobody else could save it. They practiced it under a new life and new conditions when no one else dared to undertake it. There's quite a bit of other testimony on this. Another expert said, "We owe the agricultural restoration of a great part of Europe to the monks. Wherever they came, they converted the wilderness into a cultivated country. They pursued the breeding of cattle and agriculture, labored with their own hands, drained morasses, cleared away forests. By them, Germany was rendered a fruitful country." Another historian writes that every Benedictine monastery was an agricultural college for the whole region in which it was located. I'm indebted to Thomas Wood's writing on the subject of the achievements of the monks. He cites a historian, Francois Guizot, quote, "The Benedictine monks were the agriculturists of Europe. They cleared it on a large scale, associating agriculture with preaching." Of course, manual labor is expressly called for in the rule of St. Benedict, and it plays, even today, a central role in the monastic life. Although the rule was known for its moderation and its aversion to the exaggerated penances of earlier times, we often find monks freely embracing work that was difficult and unattractive, since, for them, work that was extremely difficult was a channel of grace and opportunities for the mortification of the flesh. This was certainly true in the clearing and reclaiming of land. Until recently, the prevailing view of swamps was that they were the source of pestilence and utterly without value. So through all those centuries, the monks thrived in locations and embraced the challenges that came before them. Before long, they managed to dike and drain the swamps and turn what had been once a source of disease into arable and fertile farmlands. It is amazing how little recognition there is today about the magnitude of their efforts, about the vast areas that they totally altered into productive farmlands and gentle countrysides. For example, in the land area of England, they eventually, after 1,100 years of labor, held one-fifth of the land area. It had been uncultivated, uninhabited, covered with forests and surrounded by marshes. This was the character of much of the land that the monks occupied, partly because they chose the most secluded and inaccessible sites to reinforce the communal solitude of their life, and partly because this was the land that the lay donors were more willing to give the monks. We should be careful not to be Monday morning quarterbacks, to judge backward historically from the perspective of today. What we see as very scarce and sensitive biomes was in those days an overwhelmingly dominant natural world, unconquerable, vast, and full of dangers, and covering the majority of the landscape. Yet the monks were progressive in their care for and concern for the land.
and for the things on it. They were enlightened for their time, but even when the monks did clear forests that stood in the way of human habitation, they were careful to plant trees and conserve forests wherever possible, and actually reflecting an enlightened viewpoint far ahead of their time. Now let's turn to some specific achievements in agriculture that the monks deserve great credit for. In the development of new farming techniques, wherever they went, they introduced new crops and new production methods, new cultivation methods, with which the people had not been previously familiar. They were agricultural colleges in modern terms. They introduced the rearing of cattle and horses, the methods and practices of beekeeping in apiaries, in all its techniques, in the brewing of beer, in the way to develop productive orchards of fruit trees. In Sweden, the corn trade owed its existence to the monks. In Parma, it was cheese. Lettuce, braised Parmesan cheese, Parmigiana. In Ireland, salmon fisheries. Our fans of smoked salmon listening to this? And in a great many places, the finest vineyards. This is certainly a more famous contribution of the monks. And in the earthly world, is there a more appreciated one? The wonderful Catholic poet Hilaire Belloc wrote a poem called Catholic Sun. Wherever the Catholic sun doth shine, there's always laughter and good red wine. At least I've always found it so. Benedicamus Domino. Monks stored up waters from springs in order to distribute them in times of drought. In fact, it was the monks of the monasteries of Saint-Laurien and Saint-Martin, observing the waters of springs that were distributing themselves uselessly over the meadows of Saint-Gervais and Bayville, redirecting them to become a major part of the water supply of Paris. In Lombardy, the peasants learned irrigation from monks, which contributed mightily to making that area so well known throughout Europe for its fertility and riches. The monks were also the first to work toward improving cattle breeds, rather than leaving the process to chance. Where cattle had been improved through natural selection, they were now being improved through monk selection. Their good example and manual labor inspired others in general. Agriculture had sunk to a low ebb. Marshes covered once fertile fields, and men who should have tilled the land spurned the plow as degrading. But when the monks emerged from their cells to dig ditches and plow fields, their efforts were inspiring and almost magical. Men turned back once more to a noble but despised industry. Of course, we know that they pioneered in the production of wine, which they used both for the celebration of Mass and for ordinary consumption, which the rule of Saint Benedict expressly permitted in moderation. In addition, the discovery of champagne can be traced to monks, immediate forebears of Dom Pérignon. Dom Pérignon is certainly a most famous monk who improved the quality of champagne to the product we know today. Dom Pérignon was appointed cellular of St. Peter's Abbey in 1688. The fundamental principles he established continue to govern the manufacture of champagne even today. Looked at from an academic's perspective, perhaps these tasks, these achievements, don't seem as glamorous as some of the intellectual achievements of the monks. After all, we attribute the founding of the scientific method to the monks. These rather homely tasks and basic tasks were very nearly as important to building and preserving the civilization of the West as any philosophical or academic achievement. It would be difficult to find any group anywhere in the world whose contributions were as varied and as significant, actually as indispensable, as those of the Catholic monks of the West during a time of general turmoil and despair and chaos, sometimes called the Dark Ages. But they were illuminated by 10,000 points of light, the tens of thousands of monasteries, each centers of grace, of spiritual enlightenment, of physical well-being, of education, of medical care, a home for every traveler, no matter who he was, friend or enemy, a refuge, a sanctuary, 10,000 points of light reflecting the light of Christ's charity. We've been discussing the gifts of the monks and their great contributions to our civilization, indeed, foundational contribution. Let me credit Thomas E. Woods, Jr., Ph.D., for much of this information.
That's about all I'm going to cover in this particular podcast. The next one will take up the monks' creation and perfection of modern technology. So much of it goes back to the monks. This is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight. I've been answering the question, what good are monks? It's a laughable question, isn't it? This is BreadboxMedia.com.
Redbox Media programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
Thank you for listening to BreadBox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.